Welcome back, folks. This is Mark Steiner right here on The Mark Steiner Show and your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And we are about now to have a conversation with Tavis Smiley, of course, one of our most renowned PBS and public radio hosts. And he's joining us to talk again about this final year of King's life and to reflect a bit on the book he wrote that I just finished rereading to think about his thoughts, Death of a King, the real story of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s final year. And Tavis, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Mark, a great delight as always to be on with you, my friend.
So, Tavis, this is, you know, I was thinking about this. You know, when we talked to Taylor, we kind of really focused in on the world at that moment with King, a little reflection at the end on what it means for 2017, which we'll also get to together from your perspective. But one of the things you touched on so deeply in this book was the vitriol that Martin Luther King faced because of the speech. Not just from racists and white liberals, we can talk about them in a moment as well, but from other black folks, from people in the movement, from people not even in the movement, but just incensed at what he had just done.
Well, he delivers this speech, as you mentioned, 50 years ago today, at the Riverside Church in New York City, and because he calls America, his country, the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today. That's a bold statement, particularly from a black man in the 60s, never mind the fact that he has a Nobel Peace Prize. That's bold for him to speak that kind of truth. And so the broader majority community did not like that, obviously. And then he advances this notion of what he calls the triple threat facing our democracy, racism, poverty, and militarism, and basically says if we don't get serious about racism and extreme materialism and rampant militarism, we're going to lose our democracy. And so the price, to your point, Mark, that he pays for that is that the White House disinvites him, the mainstream media turns against him, the black media, quite frankly, turns against him. The last poll, the Harris poll, the last poll taken in his life found that nearly three-quarters of the American people, three-quarters, thought he was irrelevant. To the thesis of your point, almost 60% of his own people, 60% of black people, thought he was irrelevant. Roy Wilkins, the head of the NAACP, comes out against him publicly. Whitney Young, head of the Urban League, comes out against him publicly. The things that Thurgood Marshall says about Dr. King, I can't even use that kind of language on your radio program, Baltimore's own Thurgood Marshall, who we love and respect, but Marshall had a thing about Dr. King. At one point, he called Dr. King a boy on a man's errand. So you got all these bourgeois elites who are turned off to Dr. King. Of course, Thurgood Marshall nominated to the Supreme Court by Lyndon Johnson. So the bourgeois Negro saw Martin Luther King Jr. as getting into this tete-a-tete with the president who had been good to them. He passed the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act. This is the best president we've had in the White House since Lincoln freed the slaves. So they don't like Martin going head-to-head with the president. The bourgeois elite Negroes and the everyday young people thought that Martin was passé. Now, you and I laugh about that now, Mark. He was only 38 when he gave the speech.
Right.
But for a younger generation in Baltimore and beyond, he was passé. They wanted black power. They wanted Stokely Carmichael. They wanted Huey P. Newton. They wanted H. Brown. So Martin, even inside of his own community, has lost his constituency. And on top of that, he's disinvited to speak in black churches. And so the constituency that he once had, say, in 63 at the March on Washington, is a very different constituency than he has in 67, 68.
So there's a lot of points here. And one of the things that you point out, and I think that it's really kind of really important not to forget, is that that King, what the federal government was doing at this time, to the civil rights movement, to the anti-war movement, to King himself in their spying. You write about James Harrison, his treasurer, and his photographer, Ernest Withers, being on the FBI payroll. He didn't know it.
Yep.
People spying on him from the inside, all that going on at the same time.
Yeah. Spying on the inside, and this is, of course, the same time that the FBI, that same FBI, is advancing this COINTEL program. So they're spying on Panthers, they're spying on everybody. But in Martin's case, they had people on the inside. And as you well know, your astute audience knows, he gives this Beyond Vietnam speech April 4, 1967, they killed him 1 year to the day, almost to the hour, 1 year later, April 4, 1968. So Vincent Harding, the late, great Vincent Harding, who helped write this speech with and for Dr. King, I always felt guilty about the fact that in helping to write that speech for Dr. King, he thought that his words had put a target on Dr. King's back. Vincent Harding told me that a number of times. And so he always wrestled with that, had a great deal of lamentation about whether or not he in part was responsible for this bullet that was chasing Martin every day of his life. But one of the ways that they were able to pin down his moving and his being and where he was going to appear was because they had those spies on the inside. And literally the record now indicates, and we know well, that people like Ernest Withers, and I should be clear, Ernest Withers was just one of his photographers, so there were others.
Right, people like
Ernest Withers and James Harrison, his treasurer, were literally calling into the FBI daily, giving reports of Martin's movements. And so it wasn't very hard to track him as that bullet followed him for that full year.
So one of the things that was posited earlier was that part of what was going on, especially in Black America, which and some of the Black leadership of Black America that you just talked about a moment ago, was also because for generations from Du Bois on and in Frederick Douglass as well, that one of the ways that the Liberation War has been fought was Black men going to war, proving themselves as warriors, as Americans, you know, that we are as Black men, we are ready to be citizens because we've bled.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And that he was up against that kind of philosophy as well.
What he did in fact say in that Beyond Vietnam speech was that the bombs that you're dropping in Hanoi are landing in the ghettos and barrios of America's cities. He was concerned about these Black men dying on the front lines for their country, but didn't have equal rights or equal protection under the law when they came back home. He was bothered by the fact that Lyndon Johnson had declared a war on poverty, which would have ostensibly helped these Black men who couldn't get work, gainful employment, couldn't afford to go to college. This war on poverty program would have ostensibly have helped them here at home, but now they're fighting this war abroad. So he's mad at Johnson because Johnson has declared a war on poverty, but now he's engaged in this war in Vietnam. And what Martin says is that budgets, Mr. President, budgets are moral documents. Budgets are moral documents. You can say what you say, but you are who you are. When you put your budget on the table, we see who you are. And so Martin was just sort of seething that Johnson had passed the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act and Voting Rights Act, and now he's promised this war on poverty. He's given this great speech. He's going to put all these resources behind it. And then you get sidetracked by spending all this money on the war in Vietnam. And so, again, ostensibly the kinds of programs that this war on poverty would have aided and abetted, which would have helped to turn the tide against what was already ailing the Black community, those resources are now being squandered on this war in Vietnam. And on top of that, of course, Black men are losing their lives disproportionately.
I mean, do you think that given the time that this happened with you know, just before the year before and the Black Power March to Mississippi, Stokely Carmichael's speech on Black Power, the change in philosophy with most of the leaders of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in the South, it's putting aside nonviolence, the growth of the Panthers, the growth of the anger at the American state on the white left as well, picking up the gun, the increased militancy. I mean, could King have done anything else? Could King have responded in other ways? Could King have not been pilloried, given the moral core he had and how he had to live his life?
It's a powerful question, as your questions tend to be, Mark. And the answer for me is no. I don't know that he could have done anything differently. As a matter of fact, in the opening paragraphs of this Beyond Vietnam speech, he says, and I quote, "I've come to this house tonight because my conscience leaves me no other choice. My conscience leaves me no other choice." He goes on to say, "There comes a time when silence is betrayal." And then he talks about how the speech he's about to give, he considers a vocation of agony. "The truth that I'm about to tell you now, I consider a vocation of agony." So the answer to your question doesn't even need to come from me. We can go to Martin's own words. He just felt that his conscience left him no other choice, that to remain silent would have been betrayal, that even though it was a vocation of agony, he had to speak the truth that he did know. And that's exactly what he did. So I don't know that he had any other choice, although, as you well know, everybody in his camp save one or two. James Bevel comes to mind immediately.
Mm-hmm.
Other than James Bevel, there was really nobody in his camp who thought giving this speech was a good idea. His longtime and trusted aide, Stanley Levinson, thought it was a bad idea, and so did everybody else inside his camp. That was a bad idea, one, that it was going to cause him harm, and indeed it did, that he was going to be accused of trying to weave together the peace movement and the civil rights movement, and that wasn't going to go over well. It did not. Witness, as I said earlier, the civil rights leaders who got upset with him and came out against him publicly. So that strategy didn't work. It was going to affect their fundraising. Of course, it did in fact affect their fundraising. As you know, Dr. King could no longer raise money through his organization, SCLC, and on a personal level. So professionally, he can't raise money. On a personal level, he dies broke, and Harry Belafonte has to pay for his funeral. And then the other argument they made was, Martin, this is going to distract us from the work that we still need to do in the South. There's still so much work that needs to be done in the South, and with the Voting Rights Act and Civil Rights Act with as the wind beneath our wings, there's so much more we can get done if you don't distract us by giving this speech against the war in Vietnam. And Martin said, of course, then, that injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. I'm against violence here, there, and everywhere. His conscience left him no choice. He did what he had to do. He knew he was going to catch some hell for it, but quite frankly, Mark, he didn't even know that the hell he was going to catch was as bad as it was going to be.
Yes, because that next year things unraveled. On one level, they unraveled for King because all the attacks against him, people coming at him because of his increased militant stand against the war while maintaining his stance on nonviolence. And on the other, he grew as a man.
Yes.
In that last year of his life.
Oh, Lord, yes.
Right?
I say all the time that what you're talking about, Mark or Tavis or any of your listeners right now, we don't get to know who we truly are until the deepest, darkest midnight hours of our lives. That's when we come to know who we really are. When you have a family member who's dying of cancer, you learn about yourself as you struggle with them. When something catastrophic has happened to your child, you learn about yourself and whatever strength or weaknesses you may have. When you're trying to accomplish a professional goal and you don't quite hit the mark the first time out and you've got to go at it again, you learn something about yourself. My point is that it's only in the deep, dark, desolate hours of our lives that we come to know who we truly are. Now, if you accept that, and I certainly do, as a fact of life, then you really don't know Dr. King. No matter how well you think you know him, you really don't know him, Mark, until you see him in these deep, dark, desolate hours. And it got no darker for Dr. King. His life, when he moved to Montgomery and started and led that Montgomery bus boycott, his life was always challenged from the age of 25, 26 on when he stepped into that leadership role. From 25 to 39 when he's killed, his life was never a bed of roses. It was, you know, as the great poet said, it was not for Martin a crystal stair way. But at the end of the point is that in that last year, it was darker and more desolate and more bleak than it had ever been. So if you don't really know Martin or see Martin in this last year, from April 4, 67 to April 4, 68, and with all due respect, you really don't know Martin King. Now, we've talked about all the hell he had to catch in the last year, but to your beautiful point now, Mark, what makes the story so uplifting and so inspiring and so empowering is that Martin Luther King Jr. in that last year never took one step backward, not even to gain momentum. He didn't take a step back to even gain momentum. He kept going forward. He kept organizing the Poor People's Campaign. And I've got a friend who hosts a great radio show in Baltimore who was at Resurrection City when that thing actually came to the fore right after Martin's assassination. So he never stopped organizing this Poor People's Campaign. He knew there was a bullet with his name on it. The death threats were there every single day. Some nights he had to cry himself to sleep. But he never stopped. He never stopped organizing, and he never stopped pushing and never stopped telling the truth. Very quickly, as you know, he's killed on a Thursday night in Memphis at the Lorraine Motel, as we all know. But one of the last phone calls he had was back to his church to tell his secretary what his Sunday morning sermon was going to be. Wherever Martin was in the world on Sundays, he was always back in Atlanta to preach at Ebenezer. And by Thursday or Friday, no matter where he was, he had to call in his sermon topic so they could get it printed in the bulletin to be passed out when the members showed up for church Sunday morning. So he had to always call in his sermon. After a year of catching hell, a year of everybody and everything turning against him, the cosmos basically shifts against this guy. Had he made it back to Ebenezer on Sunday morning, Mark, the sermon that he was going to preach was entitled, why America may go to hell. After all the hell he caught, he was still so committed to telling the truth that his Sunday morning sermon was going to be called Why America May Go to Hell. Now, if that isn't courage and conviction and commitment, I don't know what is.
I mean, that almost sounds, I've been reading a lot of Vernon Johns lately, preparing for my
job. Oh, but you understand that.
Right, right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, and when you wrote this book, I love, I mean, you, in a very reverent sense, all through the book, you begin to call Martin Luther King Doc.
All the way through, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Why'd you make that choice?
Because the short answer is I wanted to, and let me just back up.
Yeah.
You mentioned Taylor Branch earlier. There are three great historians without whose work I couldn't have written this book. And my effort here was not to redo what they have done. They've done this work. But so much of this last year, this story is what I call hidden in plain sight. Taylor Branch has done the heavy lifting. David Garrow has done the heavy lifting. Claiborne Carson has done the heavy lifting. So these three brilliant historians made my writing this book just about this last year so much easier to do because they've done such great research over the years. Having said that, I wanted to put the reader in a narrative where you were inside of Martin's circle. I wanted you to understand what Martin had to go through. So with all due respect and with great humility, if Martin were going to write a book about what he had to go through for the last year of his life, this would be that book. I wanted to put you in his circle right there with him so you could be with him every step of the way as this bullet was chasing him from that speech until his death a year later. And because I wanted to put you in the circle and make you a part of his own crowd, his own group, everybody in his circle called him Doc. And so I called him Doc, and as you read the book, he becomes Doc to you. And I'm so pleased that people who've read the book, so many people, were able to situate themselves in the narrative and feel a part of his circle because you no longer had to stand back and refer to him as Dr. King. He's Doc to you, and you're a part of his circle as well.
You know, you have so many great quotes in here from King. One of them you have in here that really speaks to me to the speech he made at Riverside 50 years ago today, and it speaks volumes about who we are today. When you have this quote in here, the turmoil of the ghetto is the externalization of the Negro's inner torment and rage.
Mm-hmm.
That
speech is chock full. As a matter of fact, we started last night on my TV show on PBS with Brian Stevenson.
Yes.
And every night this week, all five nights, we are deconstructing and dissecting this speech. This speech is so important if you want to know who King really was and how subversive the truth was that he was telling that America couldn't even handle it. If you really want to know who King really was, you got to dig into this Beyond Vietnam speech. Not I Have a Dream. You got to dig. Not Drum Major Institute. Drum Major Instinct. Those are great speeches. But to know him, you got to dig into Beyond Vietnam. And so this week, I want to spend all five nights of my PBS show sort of deconstructing this speech. And so last night we had Brian Stevenson. Tonight, the day of the anniversary, we'll have Harry Belafonte, his dear and abiding friend. Wednesday night, Jeremy Scahill. We're going to deconstruct Martin's position on militarism and where we are 50 years later. Thursday night, the Reverend Dr. Otis Moss, Jr., Dr. King's abiding friend out of Cleveland, Ohio. And then Friday night, a panel of young black activists who weren't even born when Dr. King gave this speech 50 years ago, Mark. But the point of laying that out is because over these five nights, every night this week, we are pulling out different passages of this speech, and I'm glad you pulled that passage out because it just seems that so many of us only know like one or two quotes about Dr. King, and we don't know some of his best stuff because we don't know these other speeches he gave. But if you want to see King at his best, at his most poetic, at his most brilliant sort of prose wrapped in some truth-telling, you got to read this speech because the quote you just mentioned is just one of a dozen or so in this one talk.
And what you also did in this piece, I think, which is really important for people to read the book and watch your interviews this week on PBS every evening, starting last night and going through the end of the week, is that you said you got into King, the personal life of King.
Yes.
So the pieces in there you have between he and Coretta.
Yeah.
The fear they had for him.
Yeah.
His own fears that people no longer wanted to believe in nonviolence. They weren't believing in what was being done in the past and the present. I mean, King was at this moment at a fragile place, but a place of deep strength at the same time.
No doubt about
it. That dialectic was alive in him.
Oh, very much so. we now know in retrospect that King suffered a bit of mania, and the researchers, the psychologists, the psychiatrists now know from research all these many decades later that part of what allows people like Dr. King, very rare, but part of what allows people like him to have not just an empathy, but such a radical empathy for other people is in part wrestling with their own mania. It is that mania that he's wrestling with that allows him to be so radically empathetic to the plight and position of other people. Those two things we now know from the researchers are sort of inextricably linked together. That's how you explain, on top of the fact that he has such an abiding faith in his Savior, those things allow you to see and to understand how this guy could be so radically empathetic toward other people in a way that most of us could never approach. I mean, we now know from all these tapes that have been released years after his assassination, we now know that from all these tapes that have been released by the National Archives, et cetera, not one time do we ever hear Martin Luther King Jr. on. He was bugged and tapped everywhere he went. And it wasn't like Donald Trump suggesting a fake wiretapping of his office by Barack Obama. Dr. King really was wiretapped. He really was wiretapped. And we've heard all these tapes come out, Mark, over the years, and not one time on these tapes do we ever hear King disparaging white people, demonizing his enemy. My point is that King was not a perfect servant. He was a public servant. He wasn't perfect. He was just a public servant. But he was as advertised. And that made me feel so much better when I did all the research and listened to some of this stuff to get a sense of how true he was in front of the camera and behind the camera, that never on all these tapes where he's being wiretapped unknowingly does he ever say anything disparaging, demeaning, or demonizing about the enemy, even with all the hell that he was catching. So you get a glimpse of him, you know, at his most vulnerable on some of these tapes and having conversations with those who are around him. But when he's trying to tell Coretta, he's trying to tell Andy Young and tell Ralph Abernathy and Otis Moss and Gardner Taylor, he's trying to tell his friends in his inner circle that he knows he's going to die. He knows it's just a matter of time. He knows there's a bullet out there with his name on it. And every time he's trying to tell them to prepare them for this unfortunate day, trying to help get them ready, they don't want to hear it. And Coretta says, Martin, I don't want to hear that. Don't tell me that. He had no one to confide in, even though he knew that that moment was coming. So the only thing he could do was pray about it and sing about it and cry about it and just keep moving forward. But nobody in his inner circle, which you'll understand, Mark, really wanted to hear him say, you know I'm going to die, right? You know they're going to kill me, right? Nobody wanted to hear that, but that was the burden that he had to bear almost by himself.
So as we conclude, there's a few things here. I think about this one part in the book. I was trying to find it, but it was where you talk about how the establishment, even though they appeared radical on some levels and pushing the people who were around the White House, whether it was the incredible Thurgood Marshall or the kind of radical speaker, Adam Clayton Powell Jr., the congressman
Carl Rowan,
right?
Yeah.
But then you to me, there was a juxtaposition here. I think it was on the same page in the book where you talk about that and he's being attacked from these different sides. But then you talk about how his good friend was Aretha's father.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And how he did not see a contradiction between the gospel's music and the blues and soul. And that, to me, in some ways, that's like an embodiment of who King was.
Oh, yes.
How he could pull all that together.
He did it. He did it rather well. I mean, Aretha Franklin had the best seat in the house because she was just a little girl then.
Right.
But whenever Dr. King went to Detroit, he would stay at the Franklin household rather than stay at a hotel. He and her father, Reverend C.L. Franklin, were such good friends. He would stay at the Franklin household. So Aretha Franklin literally grew up making breakfast for Dr. King every morning when he stayed at their house. And so as she got older and became a star, of course, she spent a lot of time on the road raising money with her hits for Dr. King and for the movement. So she paid it forward when she finally did become a star, which didn't take long, of course. She raised a lot of money for the movement. And there are stories in the book in this last year where she showed up at places with Dr. King to help raise money for the SCLC, but he couldn't get any money from anywhere else. The Franklins always stood by him. But, yeah, Martin, like her dad, didn't really see a distinction in there and loved it. I mean, clearly his favorite singer was Mahalia Jackson, as we all know.
Right.
But there's also a funny story in this book where he snuck into the back of an auditorium one night when Ike and Tina
right.
and Sam and Dave were performing. Ike and Tina were opening for Sam and Dave. Long story, it's a very funny story. Ike and Tina were opening for Sam and Dave, and Ike and Tina had killed it. Tina came out there, as Tina always did, and she wore that thing out. And so they're off stage. The audience is still chanting, Tina, 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 Tina. Sam and Dave come out, and they're the stars. Now, they're the headliners. And the audience is still chanting, Tina, Tina, Tina. And Sam and Dave have told me this. They told me the story many times over the years, especially Sam Moore, who's still living, of course. Sam took off his shirt, took off his jacket, took off his shirt. He was doing everything he could, trying to be sexy, trying to appeal to the audience, trying to change their, trying to change the flow, and they're still chanting, Tina, Tina. And after the show, without knowing it, without knowing that Dr. King had snuck into the back of the auditorium, Dr. King went backstage after the performance, and when they saw this, said, Dr. King, you can't do the show that way. I didn't know you were here. Oh, my God. He said, yes, I was here, and I want you to know that that Tina put something on you tonight. That Tina put something on you tonight. So Tina had worn them out, and Dr. King was so tickled because he was friends with Sam and Dave and, of course, you know, the other performers. But it was just funny for me to, in the research, to find this story of Dr. King literally sitting in the back of the auditorium getting his groove on with Ike and Tina and Sam and Dave.
So I want to conclude with your thoughts on what you think this moment 50 years ago means for now in 2017, given everything we're facing in America.
Yeah.
And also what it means to you to have a smiley.
That's a powerful, powerful question, once again. First of all, it says the king, unlike these politicians that we talk about every day in the news in a contemporary sense, or even historically, and I make a distinction between politician and public servant. There are still some people who are doing this who are really doing a public service, but so many of these people are just politicians. And it's always important for me to underscore, number one, that King was never a politician. He was a prophet. He's a prophet, and there's a distinct difference. And the fact that 50 years later, we are still wrestling with the truth he told us, because, again, it was too subversive for us to handle five decades ago, we're still trying to deal with it, number one. He was a prophet. Number two, that triple threat that he talked about that was facing America then is facing America now more than ever. Our democracy and the future of it is inextricably linked to how seriously we are going to take his legacy. That legacy, to my mind, is justice for all, service to others, and a love that liberates people. That's his legacy, justice for all, service to others, and a love that liberates people. Now, you can't honor that legacy if you can't wrestle with that triple threat, racism, poverty, and militarism. Racism is still, 8 years after Obama was in the White House, racism is still the most intractable issue in this country, number one. Poverty is now threatening our very democracy. It is now a matter of national security, to be frank about it. And thirdly, you know, Mr. Trump has cut all these social programs to make more money available for the defense budget. So militarism and the military-industrial complex on steroids. So that triple threat that Martin talked about 50 years ago is more real and more dangerous now than ever before. What it says to me personally, that's the first part of your answer, but what it says about this moment that we are in, on a personal level, it just says to me that King is still the greatest American that we have ever produced. That's my assessment, and I will go to my grave believing that. He is the greatest American that this country has ever produced, not because he was the greatest orator, although he was, not because he was the most visionary, although he was, and not just because he was the most courageous, although he was, but that Martin loved us enough to tell us the truth. Whether we wanted to hear it or not, he told us the truth. And when you dedicate your life to seeking the truth, speaking the truth, standing on the truth, and staying with the truth, there is no higher calling, Mark. And you do that every day, and I appreciate you and love you for it.
Love you too, Tavis. And Tavis Smiley, we've been talking to, is the host and managing editor of The Tavis Smiley Show on public television, on public radio, noted author of how many books? 16 now?
Yeah, something like that.
Something like that? And all this week on his program, you will see and hear his interviews with people around this Riverside Speech anniversary, the 50th anniversary today. Tavis Mahle, my brother, thank you so much for joining us.
Stay strong, Mark.
The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our senior producer is Mark Gunnery. Our producer is Imani Spence. Our research producer is Calvin Perry. Our production assistant is Nadia Ramlagan. Our engineer is Andre Melton. Our intern is Michael Dixon. Our theme music is by Warren Matthews with Clean Cuts. And send me your thoughts about today's program to talk@steinershow.org. To podcast the Mark Steiner Show and share it with your friends, visit us on the web at steinershow.org or listen to us via your favorite podcasting app. And for your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.